You're listening to the heartbeat of the University of Maryland, Baltimore, the UMB Pulse.
Welcome to the UMB Pulse podcast. I'm Charles Shalee, and this is a special edition of the Pulse, which is a recording of our first ever Twitter space. We produced a Twitter space on Wednesday, August 10th, about 1905 University of Maryland School of Medicine alumnus Moonlight Graham, which you'll hear in a moment. What you're about to listen to is a condensed replay of that Twitter space, minus some technical glitches, and you'll hear that about halfway through when the Twitter space disconnected on its own. Many of you who are listening might be familiar or have watched the Kevin Costner classic Field of Dreams, or maybe you're in the younger generation and you're just hearing about Field of Dreams thanks to Major League Baseball, who hosted its second Field of Dreams games in the cornfields of Dyersville, Iowa, featuring the Chicago Cubs and Cincinnati Reds this month. Who could forget when Kevin Costner as Ray confronted James Earl Jones playing Terrence about what he saw on the Fenway Park scoreboard flashing Archie Moonlight Graham's name and stats? When Costner's character Ray asked Terrence after the ball game, "What does go the distance mean?" Terrence exclaims, "We're going to Minnesota to find Moonlight Graham." It really is the moment that sets the Field of Dreams movie in motion. Moonlight Graham seemed to have found our guest, Larry Petroff, who is the executive director of the Medical Alumni Association of the University of Maryland. Larry discovered some previously unknown letters and correspondence at the University of Maryland School of Medicine's Gray Hall that are tied to Moonlight Graham. We're going to get into the discovery and dive into the contributions to medicine by Moonlight Graham that you might never have realized. If you would like to see a visual representation of these artifacts and the tweets during the Twitter space, please visit the UM Baltimore account. Unfortunately, the audio quality of a Twitter space when you download a recording isn't the greatest, so we apologize for any technical difficulties from the platform. And with that, here's our program with Dana Rampola and Larry Petroff.
Hi, Larry. Welcome to our space. We're so excited to have you here today for this conversation. I think Charles noted you're the executive director of the Medical Alumni Association here at UMB, and we have a lot to talk about. As Charles mentioned, we're going to touch on the movie. We're going to talk a little bit about the actual games that are played at the Field of Dreams, but let's start with your discovery. Tell us, what in the world, how did you even find these signatures? What are they? Where were they? And truthfully, tell us, did you hear a voice whispering to you from a file cabinet or a closet beckoning you to come?
Yes, Dana, that's what happened. No, it actually wasn't a voice, but it certainly was a feeling that had been wearing on me for a number of years. I started at Maryland about 5 years after the movie came out, and I was made aware that Archie Graham was a graduate of the University of Maryland School of Medicine. And a couple of years later, I had the benefit of writing a book for our bicentennial celebration and was able to include the passage of Dr. Graham and his attending Maryland and appearing in the movie. But the truth is that I made the assumption that all the files had been exhausted on Dr. Graham. And in reality, up in our storage area of the Gray Hall, where we keep all the alumni artifacts and things, there was a file cabinet there that was marked 1812 to 1916. And I can't tell you how many times I walked up there and looked at that filing cabinet and asked myself if I should be checking just to ensure that there's nothing in there on Dr. Graham. So it was after the first Field of Dreams game last August that I promised myself that the next time I was up in that storage area, I would take a look. And it was in middle of October, I think, and went into the file cabinet. And Dana, that file and these documents were laid out so impeccably well. They were just screaming to be found. And I don't mind telling you that it was a tremendous rush of excitement. But at the same time, there was a good dose of embarrassment that I'd waited so long before I had looked.
Well, what did you do when you first found them? I mean, you are a history buff, so you had to have been super excited just
to have
seen them in person.
Yeah, actually just sat back on a box and continued to fiddle through to find out how many there actually were. In looking at these documents throughout a more than 100-year history, there isn't a lot on any one individual, but this file on Dr. Graham was just extensive, and much had to do with the fact that he was traveling and playing baseball during the summers, and so he wasn't able to communicate by walking into the school and asking the dean for his transcripts or to pay a tuition bill or whatever it might be. He had a right, and so these correspondences cover a period of about 2 years and go into quite some detail and are actually very revealing about the person that Archie Graham was.
And so would you say that in this file cabinet, there were letters from many, many students, or were these special because they were from?
Primarily all graduates. They were letters of recommendation from the dean out to superintendents of hospitals for training programs that our alumni had applied for at the time, validating that they graduated from the University of Maryland. But nowhere could I find, I should back up a step, there are matriculation cards for virtually everyone during that era. And that was significant because of the financial constraints that the university was in. But when it came down to the personal correspondences, Dana, there were very few that were as in-depth as what we found with Archie Graham.
Very interesting. And Larry, you just mentioned about the time. So let's take a step back. Let's kind of set the scene for everyone. Before we talk about how Archie actually came to Maryland, what did the University of Maryland School of Medicine look like at the turn of the 20th century?
That's a great place to start, because you can really understand the narrative a lot better with what these files indicate when you understand where we were as a school. And I think most people know that in 1807, we were founded as a private medical college that morphed into a university 5 years later in 1812. But the truth is that we were founded by a group of doctors who were interested in teaching medicine. And so you could get a two-year degree when the school first opened up, and that a medical degree, and that actually lasted until the 1890s. But it was after the Civil War when medical schools started popping up everywhere throughout the country. And this was due to the fact that medicine was not a lucrative business. Now, if you had a practice in Manhattan or Chicago in a large city, you could actually do okay as a physician. But for those who were practicing out in the farming communities in the rural areas, you really had to have a second career. Some were farmers, some were lawyers, some were parishioners. But it was a very trying time back then to be a full-time faculty member. And so a lot of doctors formed what they called medical colleges. And now some of these schools were excellent. They were ground in basic sciences and they were associated with universities, but the vast majority of them were not. They were glorified apprenticeship programs where doctors could be taking their students with them on house calls. And, 2 years later, they'd have this degree in medicine. So very trying time for organized medicine. In 1876, the American Association of Medical Colleges comes along, and it's founded in Washington, D.C. for the exclusive purpose of organizing medical education and standardizing it. And the first thing they do is they recommend that there be a four-year medical education and that these colleges are all aligned with universities. By that time now, you get into the 1890s, there were about 160 medical schools in North America. And 1893 is when Johns Hopkins opened up. And at that time, Dana, in Baltimore alone, when Hopkins opened its door in 1893, there were five medical schools in Baltimore. There was us, there was Johns Hopkins, there was the Women's Medical College of Baltimore, there was the Baltimore Medical College and the Baltimore College of Physicians and Surgeons. So you can imagine how competitive this must have been to attract students. And it resulted in tuitions being lowered and standards being lowered. Now, Hopkins really didn't have that problem because when they opened up in 1893, they were so richly endowed that they probably didn't have to have a student and they would have stayed in business. But for all the other four schools that were tuition-driven institutions, tuition mattered. And so it was very competitive. Now, I'm going to fast forward a little bit on the other side of Archie Graham, and then we can get into the questions you want to have. But in 1910, the Carnegie Foundation had charged Abraham Flexner with producing the Flexner Report, which he visited all 60 medical schools in North America and came up with the scathing report on medical education in America. And he recommended that we reduce from 160 schools in North America to like 33, and all the rest should be closed. It was a sexist and a racist report. He recommended that five of the seven black medical colleges closed. He virtually wanted all of the women's medical colleges closed, and he wanted all the other remaining schools to be aligned with universities that presented a four-year medical education, with 2 years being ground in the basic sciences, and then the 2 years in a clinical setting, very similar to what Johns Hopkins was doing at the time. And that resulted in us finally by 1920 surviving, but relinquishing control and turning control of the university over to the state. And that's when we became the great public institution we are today. So that's the transition that is occurring. And Archie comes to school in 1903 when all of this is playing out right before our very eyes.
Yeah, so let's hop back over to talking about Archie a little bit. He was born in Fayetteville, North Carolina, graduated from UNC Chapel Hill, and he had a pretty interesting and large family with deep roots in that North Carolina area. How did he wind up here in one of those
schools? Yeah, there were ten siblings. All of them were well educated. And now, again, to fit this narrative of medical education, Maryland in 1893 went to a four-year curriculum, and it was a real challenge for us. But the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, did not. They maintained a two-year AB certificate that they were awarding, and it was a science-based certificate. And Maryland found out about it and approached UNC with an offer that, again, starving for students, that we would accept any UNC graduate, a two-year AB certificate into our curriculum, and they could come and complete the final 2 years of school at the University of Maryland. So you are correct. Archie plays, he grows up in Fayetteville, North Carolina. He plays ball at Chapel Hill. He's a gifted athlete and sees this opportunity now to complete his education. And he's going to try to do it by nurturing a baseball career as well.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about that. How did he juggle that? What did that look like for him to try to play baseball? He also was a football player at some point too, right?
He was a very gifted athlete. And back then, you could actually compete in collegiate athletics and be a professional athlete. He signed his first major league professional contract to play in the minor leagues in 1902. And the first trace we have of him is him showing up through his brother by writing to us. His older brother, David, writes us and says, you know, my brother was accepted here to be a member of the 1902 class. And due to unforeseen circumstances, and we know what those were, he signed a major league or a minor league contract. He's unable to play ball. He's unable to attend school here. And I wonder, since I completed this two-year program, if you'll permit me the opportunity to take his space, which is granted by our dean, Dr. Cole. And he writes back again and says, can you send me a list of boarding schools in the area? I'd like to take up residency there. And just a footnote for David Sloan, the oldest brother, he develops vision problems and is unable to complete his medical education here. He attends just 1 year and then drops out and tries to get enrolled in some other programs, winds up joining the military. And he tragically dies in France during World War I in 1918.
Well, how lucky for him that all he had to do was hang on his brother's coattails. I'm sure he was gifted and bright as well, but interesting that could have even happened. Certainly that's not happening.
Yeah, but getting back to your Archie Graham story about balancing the two professions, I doubt very seriously you could do that today. As a matter of fact, I think if a major league or a professional league baseball player ever applied to medical school here, they'd probably be told to come back and apply once you're finished with baseball. Back then you could do it because ball players were looking for work in the off season, and physicians, you know, they had to have a supplemental career. And as long as I think Dr. Graham could find his opportunities once school completed for training, he'd probably be pretty much set. Now he did play on the football team as well as the baseball team. He was recognized overall as a very gifted athlete. He was voted as the most valuable baseball player during both years he attended Maryland here. But between school years, Dana, between his third and fourth year of medical school, he was in New England playing in the Manchester, New Hampshire, playing in the New England League. And that's where a trail of the correspondences pick up. As I said earlier, he couldn't walk over to the medical school if he had a question between school years. He was in Manchester living at a boarding house and playing baseball out there. And so he's asking the dean if he can send him some of his grades, and he's sending Dr. Cole some names of prospective students who he's running into there, which would have been a very wonderful and appreciated gesture on his part. And in these correspondences, we find out that he was a terrific student. The dean remarks on how well he did in his grades that he was forwarding to him. Dr. Graham is asking him about training opportunities.
And as you probably could tell, that is when the Twitter space disconnected. And here's the resumption of our program.
So where were we, Dana?
Yeah, so we were talking, where were we? Thanks for hopping back on, Larry. We were talking about the climate, what it was like here at the turn of the 20th century. And I was just getting ready, actually, to hop in and ask you about the informal rules of that era, allowing college athletes to play professional sports.
Yeah, that was they were all ahead of their time. There wasn't much of an issue. These collegiate athletic associations were just beginning to form, and they had a lot of professional athletes who were attending school and were able to play. So Archie was able to compete in two sports. He was a member of our football team and played baseball as well. He was a very, very gifted athlete. The word was that his speed was his primary asset. So you can imagine how valuable that would have been on the base paths and out in right field, which is the position player that he was in baseball. So it was not difficult. And I think, you know, it was pretty clear on each of the teams at Maryland, there had to be a faculty advisor, and they were aware of his athletic abilities. And I think in the long run, you know, they were more than tolerant. They knew he was a gifted athlete, that he was planning a dual career in medicine and baseball, but they knew baseball was fleeting. And they were, in fact, in all of these correspondences, baseball's never mentioned. When the dean is communicating with Archie Graham, it's all about academics. And they wanted to see to it that this very bright young man who showed all these attributes of being a fabulous physician was going to get all the nurturing.
So once baseball was behind Archie, he found himself in Chisholm, Minnesota while he was there. What contributions did he make to that community, the world of medicine? What was his life like then? Larry?
It turns out Archie Graham had a respiratory issue, and breathing was always a problem for him that would flare up every once in a while. So after baseball ended in 1908, and that's a little bit different than was told in the movie, he started training in earnest, and he attended a ear, nose, and throat training program in Chicago, and found out about a forum that was going on at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. So he traveled to Rochester and found the air out there so clean and crisp, and enjoyed the environment so much that he basically just contacted Chicago and said, "I'm not coming back." And so he took a train to Chisholm, Minnesota, which was recommended by a colleague of his, showed up in this very small community, and literally fell in love with it overnight, established a private practice. Now, again, when we talk about physicians in rural communities, they weren't making a lot of money back then. So a couple of years after he had established his practice, he was invited to become the school physician for the Chisholm School District, which he gladly accepted. Now, he had training in a number of different disciplines. I don't recall seeing any for pediatrics, but he was a gifted man and started treating these young patients in the school system. And I'm going to read between the lines a little bit here, Dana, and suggest that he probably detected some anomalies in some of the workups he was doing on some of his young patients, and saw these in the blood pressure, because he approached the school system a short time later and suggested that a comprehensive study be undertaken on childhood blood pressure with children in the Chisholm School District. Now, that was readily accepted by the district, but the medical community kind of crossed their eyes at him, because it was largely believed back then that hypertension was an affliction that adults needed to be concerned with, and that it not necessarily be an issue for children. But he pressed ahead anyway, and this study involved about 3,500 students, you know, ages 5 to about 16 years, as they made their way through the school system, and it established baseline blood pressures, demonstrated that if there were anomalies in these blood pressures, that it needed to be investigated, because it had long-reaching ramifications on these young people's lives. So this went on for 15 years, and he ran into a couple of colleagues at the Mayo Clinic who found out about the research he had done. And these were scientists and researchers, and they secured a grant at the time. I think it was about a $5,000 grant from the Josiah Macy Foundation, which was a lot of money back then. Someone helped organize the data, which was compiled into a paper that appeared in the American Journal of Diseases of Children. Now, that journal was the forerunner of the JAMA Pediatrics Journal. So it was a big deal. And he presented those findings at the Mayo Clinic in 1945. And it literally changed the understanding and what needed to occur in the treatment of children. And that affected medical education, the way medicine was taught to students. It certainly impacted the way pediatricians taught their treated their young patients. But I would argue that it impacted us all. You know, we were all the beneficiaries as children of Dr. Graham's research. And, you know, I can just think back in my early days in the 1960s and 1970s when we were competing in sports or trying out or planning to go to a camp, when there was a physical examination that was required. And one of the things that was done was that our blood pressure was taken. And you can thank Dr. Graham for that.
Great. It's really interesting. He also was practicing during a time of the typhoid epidemic, the polio epidemic. So
can you imagine?
Yeah. In medicine was busy, and he's, you know, creating these new hypotheses.
He's nursing this community through a number of endemics, including the the Spanish flu of 1918. So you can imagine the caring and considerate approach she had to take on all these different endemics, learning about them, making recommendations to the community. But he's recognized as a real hero in that community for those efforts.
Well, Larry, let's wrap up a little bit here by talking about the Field of Dreams movie. I know many of us have seen it. It's been more than 30 years since it was created. Why do you think there's this continuing fascination with movies?
Boy, that's a great question. And it's a movie that just won't go away, will it? I mean, it really is. I kind of consider that the Wizard of Oz of baseball movies. You know, it's one that came out, got some recognition, and it just doesn't go away. My personal belief is, first of all, the movie was chock full of superstars. You know, Kevin Costner and James Earl Jones and Ray Liotta, and then of course the great Burt Lancaster, who played Archie Graham so impeccably well. I think that character of Graham was one that we all could identify with. He was this wise senior physician at the beginning of the movie that gladly gave up baseball to become something much larger in life that could impact so many more people. And you know, a modern day Archie Graham, I always think of Ted Lasso, the very popular sports show, a series that's on right now, and Ted Lasso is a coach of a Premier League team in England who doesn't know anything about soccer, but he knows everything about dealing with people, and his integrity is impeccable, and he somehow makes us all a little bit better at who we are by being there. And I think that's the role that Dr. Graham played in that movie, portrayed by Burt Lancaster. And when you couple that with the difference between Archie Graham and Ted Lasso, we found out that Archie Graham was a real person. So there was this surge for information on who Dr. Graham really was, and did he live up to the character? And what we have found, and what we continue to find, and what we found in these correspondences at the University of Maryland, is that not only did he live up to the character as portrayed by Burt Lancaster, but I would argue that he actually exceeded that character. He was such an impeccably kind, concerned, and compassionate man, and he lived his whole life that way. And that's what made him special. I think that resonates with people who watch the movie.
Right. And symbolically, of course, you see that when he saves the little girl from choking on her hot dog, he goes back to, you know, he crosses the line and returns to being the doctor.
Yeah, Dana, that's my favorite segment of the movie, when he drops that baseball glove, right when he's towing the line, and you see that baseball glove drop on the dirt, and he steps up, he steps across in his clothes, you know, in his non-uniform get up.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. I was just going to say, on that topic of, you know, the character of Moonlight Graham, how it was portrayed in the film and the fascination with the real person. You want to hear some fun movie trivia about the Moonlight Graham character in Field of Dreams?
Sure.
So the scene where James Earl Jones was interviewing a bunch of different people who were friends of Moonlight Graham in the bars and telling stories, those were actual friends of the real life Archie Graham telling real life stories about him. Yeah, and all of that was true. They flew the friends of Dr. Graham out for filming, so that way they could film them actually speaking about the actual person. And then the other bit of trivia that I have is when they first come to his doctor's office to find him, and his former secretary is reading his obituary, those were real excerpts from the actual Dr. Graham's obituary that was printed in the newspaper.
That's pretty neat. Thanks for sharing that, Jen. Jen's mm-hmm. always doing her homework. Gotta love having a good scene.
I have lots of movie trivia in the back pocket.
Awesome. Do we have any questions from our listeners?
We do have a question about, so Moonlight Graham was doing school and playing ball at the same time. Is that something that people could do nowadays? Could they attend medical school and play ball? Do you think that's something that would be possible, Larry?
I highly doubt that it would be. They'd be able to do that today. Growing up in the 60s and 70s, there were some MDs who played baseball. One that I remember quite vividly was Medich. He went by that name. He was a pitcher for the Detroit Tigers. Today, I think it's gotten far too competitive. I think just getting into medical school, the admissions office would probably tell you, look, give baseball your best shot, and when it's over, reapply. Certainly in the training programs that run a year at a crack, there wouldn't be any opportunity for a break for a baseball season.
I do find it interesting. My job history, I've worked over at Shop Trauma, which of course is our affiliate here at the University of Maryland, Baltimore, and then here in our own schools. We do oftentimes, several counts, we've had ex-professional athletes come on board to study. We had a dental student who graduated, who had been an athlete. So definitely people leaving the field and coming here, but I don't know about doing it simultaneously. Larry, is there anything that we're leaving out that we should be talking about? Did we really talk about how often or what Archibald Moonlight Graham's experience was on the professional field? I'm not sure that we mentioned what that is, in case we have a listener who's not aware.
Yeah, that's a good question. He played, six, 7 years in the minor leagues, and by all accounts, was a really talented ball player. One of the discrepancies between the movie and real life was his major league debut. In the movie, it's the last game of the season, and he gets his inning in the outfield and doesn't get a chance to at bat, and then he gives up baseball and goes on to medicine. When in reality, he was up at the majors right after graduation. In May of 1905, he stayed up there for about 3 weeks, and he was in the outfield for two innings, was on the on-deck circle to bat in the top of the ninth inning, but never got his chance, and he was released from his contract right after that game. And so it must have been a very trying time for him to have been up at the show, as they call it, and then having to finish the final 3 months in Scranton, Pennsylvania with the minor league team. He didn't give up hope, and that's when one of the letters he authored to Dr. Cole was right after the season ended. He was looking for some training opportunities, but he thought well enough to send the final $30 he owed the medical school for his tuition and fees in September of that year, which really lends itself, I think, to the character of the man that he was, that he felt he had an obligation that he had to fulfill and was grateful for the education that he received at Maryland.
He does sound like a truly wonderful person, especially when we talk about and reflect upon all of the great things that he did in the field of medicine and for his community, not only teaching, but the medical care. This has been a great conversation. I hope that at UMB we can do more of these. If anyone has a last minute question, feel free to submit it. We'll stay on for a couple of minutes. And do check out the Twitter space, because our colleague Charles has been adding a lot of really interesting tidbits in the Twitter feed, including images of the actual signatures and letters that Larry discovered just a few weeks ago.
Yeah, Dana, I'll jump in here for a second. Thanks for mentioning those. You know, there are all sorts of fun little facts that you can glean from these letters and correspondences, depending how much you want to dive down. And, you know, one thing that we mentioned in the tweets is that, you know, Moonlight Graham responds to the dean and says, "Hey, you know, here's my current address, 238 West 56th Street in New York City." Well, you know, New York City's a big city and things turn over, but sometimes you have some older buildings. Well, just pop that address into Google Maps and, you know, he was really just steps from Central Park, just a couple blocks from Central Park, Carnegie Hall. And if you're wondering what that building is today, the building's still there. It's just that the ground floor is a restaurant called Fujisi, and they probably still have apartments above there. So it can very well be that somebody is staying in the same room today as Moonlight Graham. That's just one of the cool things to look through all these correspondences. And you know, Larry as well, I don't know if you want to address this, but you can really put a timeline between graduation and his game by looking at these correspondences and figuring out what he was doing between, you know, that initial ask.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was busy preparing and juggling two future careers. And, you know, I'll just add to your New York address, Charles, you know, the building that Archie Graham studied in Davidge Hall remains today. You can walk into that building and see the lecture hall where he studied.
Absolutely. And that's our past podcast episode. We had Larry in as a guest to talk about Davidge Hall on the UMB Pulse podcast. So if you're interested in listening to that, just go on Apple Podcasts or any podcast provider and search for it. And you can learn about the oldest medical education building still being used in the Western Hemisphere. I'll turn it over to you, Dana.
That's all I have, Larry. Are there any parting words or parting thoughts that you'd like to share that we may have left out?
No, you know, we're very proud of Dr. Graham. I'll just say this. He was a great guy, a real humanitarian, a scholar, and he's probably not a lot different than the other 8,000 living graduates we have at the University of Maryland. We're proud of them all.
Thank you again to Larry Pitroff for his time. As I mentioned during the conversation, Larry was a guest this summer for our road trip series highlighting the historic Davidge Hall here on the podcast. To get your history fix, you can also listen to the Pulse's current episode about the Dr. Samuel D. Harris National Museum of Dentistry. That's available now to listen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to hear us. In September, the UMB Pulse resumes its Changemaker series. Our guest will be the University of Maryland School of Medicine professor, Matthew Freeman. Matthew will discuss the current state of COVID-19 research and what scientists know about the behavior of this evolving disease. That episode will be released Friday, September 2nd. For updates on the UMB Pulse, visit us at umaryland.edu/pulse or drop us a line at umbpulse@umaryland.edu. And thank you for listening to the UMB Pulse.
The UMB Pulse with Charles Chalee, Dana Rampola, and Jenna Frick is a UMB Office of Communications and Public Affairs production. Edited by Charles Chalee, sound engineering by Jenna Frick, marketing by Dana Rampola. Music by No Vibe, recorded in the University of Maryland Baltimore Community Engagement Center.